Welcome to Alchemy 101, the show where we explore the many paths to transformation and aim to mine a few nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though sometimes it might feel counterintuitive, just like the nightingale, a bird that sings in the dark. I'm JJ, otherwise known as the Practical Alchemist, and thank you so much for joining me. Today's show is brought to you in association with NasalGuard, the drug-free nasal gel that uses electrostatic technology to block harmful airborne contaminants. It blocks indoor and outdoor allergens, so it's great for travellers as well as people with pet allergies. More about NasalGuard later, but first, you may be aware that it's been Mental Health Awareness Week. Now, the mental health arena is a broad church, and it's great that we're talking about it these days. But there are so many aspects of mental health, and one of them really isn't talked about that much. And that's trauma and its effects, not so much the more dramatic PTSD, but the less obvious damage that trauma can cause. Charlie Webster knows how trauma in its many forms can impact our lives only too well, and she's written a book about it, Why It's Okay to Talk About Trauma, How to Make Sense of Our Past and Grow Through the Pain. Charlie is an award-winning broadcaster, a journalist, campaigner and a documentary maker, and she's an ambassador as well for Women's Aid, Malaria No More and the NSPCC Children's Charity, all of it stemming from her own lived experience. She's carved out a successful career for herself in spite of trauma. Sports fans may have seen her presenting on various TV channels, so I asked her what prompted her to write the book.
It's a good question because I think it happened over different periods of time, and even the book culminates into this journey of a lot of things that I've experienced and grown through to get to this point to be able to write a book, which is called Why It's Okay to Talk About Trauma. But there was a couple of pivotal moments, and one of them was I made a documentary for the BBC called Nowhere to Run, and afterwards I got thousands upon thousands of comments and questions, and people that really were struggling either as individuals with what was going on for them and how they were feeling, or family members that were struggling to help their daughter or their son or their parent. And I sat there for hours and hours trying my hardest to reply to people and give, the insight and this experience that I've got into my own journey and processing trauma, basically, and how we understand what's happened to us. And then during COVID, I set up a mental health group as well called Mind Talk, and I did it online during COVID. And honestly, sometimes I was online for like 8 hours, and there was people that were really struggling to the point of like suicidal thoughts. And again, I wish I could kind of put it all down on paper, right? And I'm only one person, I work so much and I'll give so much time, but I'm still only one person, right? So then that's in a way what started to initiate it, is I started to write things that I'd learned and that I'd been through, and what I used to feel and what I sometimes still feel now. And that's basically how the book came about. And one more point I wanted to make, because another thing that fed into it was there was a point where, I really struggled a couple of points in my life, and but a lot of the time I didn't get help. I ran away from it. And there was a point, which I'm sure we'll talk about, where I'd been critically ill in hospital, and I was afterwards, the concentration was a lot about physicality, right? And nobody really talked about the emotional impact that had on me. I was in a coma for 2 weeks, and I was critically ill out of nowhere and nearly died. And in that moment, I knew that I needed to get help. But I was on a waiting list, and I had to go through this process, and I searched for something, some resource, maybe a book that I could see myself in, that I could relate to about how I was feeling, that I could feel less isolated in. And there wasn't. So hopefully I've written that. That's what I wanted it to be. I want people to see their own selves, their own pain, their own anger, their own sadness, but their own hope through my book, and it for it to be a support and help them feel less isolated, because you know what? It's okay. I feel the same, and I understand.
Yeah, because it is very common, isn't it, for people to feel they have to sweep these emotions, these feelings, it's a post-traumatic stress, literally, yeah, under the carpet, because they don't feel that anybody would understand or want to know.
Exactly.
Or, yeah. So, I mean, kudos to you for writing this book, because I think that's fantastic. And I do love, but it's something that I see so often doing these shows, is that people who have gone through it start writing about it because they think, well, nobody, I couldn't find a book anywhere about what, yeah, I've been going through. So here it is, right? And hopefully other people can benefit from that. So brilliant. Well done. And of course, so now what I'm sure people want to hear is, if you're happy talking about it, which I think you are, because you say it's okay to talk about trauma, what was your trauma?
A lot. So, you know, I think, again, it's an interesting question you've asked, because, well, what even is trauma? Because I think that there was a lot of points in my life where I would never have even said that my life was trauma. You know, it was just my life. Maybe these things happened to me because I wasn't good enough. Maybe, you know, all these kind of things that went on in my head, rather than understanding, actually, I'd been through a lot of distressing things. So no wonder sometimes I felt really depressed. No wonder I would have low feelings and low mood. No wonder I would feel anxious. No wonder these things would trigger me. But if you don't understand that you've been through that trauma, it's really hard to recognize that. And then you feel like, well, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
And rather than understanding your past and what you've been through, which is pretty much what the book is and the premise of it. So, you know, from a young age, I was raised in a home of domestic abuse, and there was a lot of chaos and a lot of fear. And, you know, I experienced that as a child, to watch your mum be degraded, you know, and be so unhappy and sad and in fear all the time. But also that was also projected on me, where I was told I was not good enough. You know, I was also physically abused. And then as a teenager, I actually, well, as an 11-year-old, I found running. So, you know, actual running, yeah, you know, and it was like an escapism for me, and I loved it. And I'd go training, you know, 4 or 5 times a week, and I was actually good at it. And it made me feel like I was worth something. And it was also an outlet for my emotions, right? But then I got groomed and sexually abused by my running coach in that environment, and which is what I made my documentary about, because he did get put in prison. He was convicted. But sadly, two of the girls in that group, and we were a small all-girls group, we were elite, we were, you know, very high achieving. And I'm from Sheffield in South Yorkshire in England. And everybody wanted to be in that group. But that was almost part of his, like, that was his protective mechanism. That, yeah, was him stopping people, you know, really seeing what he was actually doing, because, you know, it was this, like, you know, this group that everybody wanted to be in, and all the girls in it won all the races, you know? So then I was, you know, groomed and sexually abused in that environment, which was my initial safe space from my home. And then you kind of go into adulthood, and then you're just left to, well, how do I even deal with these things that have happened to me? And I didn't even want to acknowledge them in a way. And so I just didn't talk about it. And I, you know, ran. I don't want to use the pun, but I did run away from it. But no matter how far I ran and all these amazing things that I did, which I did, like I built a fabulous career, and because I wanted to you know, create a different person and also create some safety maybe. But within that, I didn't deal with what the impact that those things had had on me. And then something which I just briefly mentioned to you, which is what led me to get help. You know, if that wasn't enough, you know, 7 years ago, 7.5 years ago now, I cycled 3,000 miles for charity from London to Rio. And I always have a little laugh whenever I say that, because it's kind of quite bonkers, really, what I did. And I did the whole charity, you know, cycle ride. It had never been done before. It was me and three guys. And, you know, we raised money for underprivileged children, which is what my background is. That's where I'm from. And a lot of, you know, a lot of that fed into my trauma. My mum had me when she was 16. She was a teenager. You know, there was times when we were homeless. You know, I didn't have anything. And I always, you know, and I suppose when I went into my media career, I felt like, you know, maybe I wasn't good enough to be in that. And then I did the cycle ride and arrived in Rio when I was about to present on the Olympic Games, which was in 2016. So actually in August, it'll be coming up to 8 years. And I fell critically ill pretty much the night that I arrived, and the next day I was meant to be hosting the Games. And it is a very long story, but I ended up in a coma on life support, and my mum was flown over, and everybody was told I got 24 hours to live, and I have malaria and three other tropical diseases which are very hard to pronounce.
Wow. how did you manage to get all that? Just,
well, because I was cycling through,
because you were cycling through all these different countries.
Yeah, and I cycled close to the Amazon, and who knows, I mean, we'll probably never ever know, right? Yeah. Because, you know, the doctors had initially didn't even know what it was and what was going on with me. They were testing me for everything, and they were just trying to keep me alive, basically. So, you know, in the end, my lungs collapsed. I had multiple organ failure, and I was just put on life support while they tried to figure out, you know, keep me alive, basically, to try and figure out how to treat me. But yeah, you know, I got bitten by a mosquito, which is the tiniest little thing, but it's the deadliest, the deadliest thing in the world, actually, and the biggest killer of humans.
Yeah.
It carries a parasite called malaria. And apparently I had a rare form of malaria that was just basically eating me from the inside out. It was basically eating me alive. But there was complications, because I also had another parasite, which you get from a mosquito. And then I had bacterial diseases as well, that I don't know how it all fed into each other. And yeah, and it just caused massive hemorrhaging. I had hemorrhaging and multiple organ failure, and it just took over my body, and I had no red blood cells anymore, and they were giving me God knows how many blood transfusions. I had, I think it was well over 50. And you know, thank God I was put on life support, and I had the medical facilities at the time. It was in Rio, de Janeiro in Brazil. But yeah, it's quite remarkable, because I had a book launch party, and some just now, when somebody said, they gave a little talk, and they said, God, I would never have thought that I would be stood here after getting the phone call about, when, you know, telling her. It was somebody I'm very close to, but that's also, I've done a lot of work with around at Women's Aid, which is a charity, domestic abuse. And she said, she kind of held my book and said, I can't believe that I'm stood here holding your book, when I'd never thought that when I got that phone call, and, you know, what I was told, that you might not even live, because I think it was like a 0.0000% chance that I'd survive. And the consultants and the doctors said it was a total miracle, because on paper I shouldn't be here. So yeah, there's kind of a lot's happened, and that really did change me. And it helped. And it took me on a journey to try and, you know, to work through the things that had happened to me. And because, you know, when, you know, trauma to me is, we have this word for it, but trauma is something that's caused us distress and, you know, made us feel unsafe, and it can cause a lot of shame and a lot of hurt. And it's when we're kind of left with all these emotions of what it's made us feel, and then we just don't know what to do with them, and we don't process them. And it's so important, because we kind of then go on this like we can get stuck and we go on this like cycle sometimes of like unhealthy behavior patterns to try and cope with these emotions that we just keep pushing down. You know, and I know I've just kind of talked a little bit and listed some of the things that I've gone through, but this, my book, you know, it's interesting. You asked me about what made me write it.
Mm.
And I could have written a memoir, but I didn't want to. I wanted to write a book that included my experiences. So it's, you know, it's been described as like part memoir and part self-help, but I wanted it to be a combination, which I think is quite unusual, where it's like a journey that you go on through my book to help process and understand the things that you've gone through.
Well, I think that's a brilliant idea. And it's something that I'm very much on board with as well, because I think that, you know, it's all very well for people to talk about their experiences, but unless you can offer some kind of value or some kind of, you know, help to help others who are going through similar things get through it, I think, you know, it's just a little bit of voyeurism. You know, I think it's really important to offer some of the helpful stuff as well as the experience. So, you know, well done for doing that, because I think it's really, really important. And, you know, I have not had the same extreme life experiences as you have, but I can empathize with a lot of what you're saying. And, you know, you go through things and you don't really feel that you can talk to anybody about it. You don't even know that you said just now, you weren't even aware really of the fact that some of this trauma was affecting you. And I think that's so true for a lot of people.
Mm.
You go through things and you're not even aware that this is having an incredible impact on your life.
Well, we'll hear Charlie's response to that in a moment. First, it's time to take a short break to hear these messages.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and Charlie Webster, author of Why It's Okay to Talk About Trauma. We were making the point before the break that so often we have no idea how trauma might be impacting our lives. And I asked Charlie, how then can we move past our trauma? Also, many people listening to her story might well be wondering how on earth she's still with us.
Yes, a good question. I just want to pull up on the point that you just made, because it's so interesting and it's such a good point about, and then I'll ask the question of how I'm here today.
You don't have to answer that, but you know.
I'm like, a combination of probably a million things, to be honest.
Exactly.
But it was such a good point that you made, because a lot of the time we don't know that that's trauma, and we just carry on and we don't realize that these things affect us. Like, you know, the byline of the book is, you know, is about basically understanding our past and growing through the pain. Because if we don't understand our past and how it affects us, then it's very hard for us to make a change. And that's why a lot of the time there is this self-perpetuating behavior. And look, it's nothing that's happened to me is my fault.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that helped me is go, hang on a second. I'm now accountable for myself. I didn't get a choice when I was younger. You know, I didn't get a choice in a lot of my life. And, you know, even as an adult, you know, there was still a lot of domestic abuse within my family. But actually now I'm an adult and I can choose to help myself, to not keep myself in that pain and those behaviors. So again, it's not any blame on anybody. It's about going, oh, hang on, I deserve better than this. And because I, you know, I had this like horrible voice in my head to myself, you know, like I would give everything to somebody else, but then I'd tell myself that I wasn't enough. And I'd never say that to anybody else. I'd tell myself that, you know, I wasn't lovable, that, you know, these things happened to me and there was a shame in there and I felt like I was a failure, or, you know, that happened to me because, you know, there must be something wrong with me. But I kept on saying those things in my head. And obviously that's from the past. That's from those things that have happened to me, but I never really connected that. So we imagine if I kept, you know, if I said that in this whole interview, if I just said that to you all the time, you're going to come off the interview, and no matter how self-assured you are and how much self-worth you've got, that's going to affect you. Mm. Right. And so I was doing that to myself every minute of every day, but without even really realizing, and even realizing where it came from. And I think sometimes, you know, I was exactly the same. This is exactly what I've done. This is what's led me to write the book. Like, I'm not coming from it as a place of like, here you go, everybody, look at me. Yeah, it's a place of like, you know, this has happened. This has happened to me. I know how that feels. I have been at the lowest of the lowest, and I promise you, you can come out of it, but you might still feel these things. You know, and I think that, but that's sometimes the biggest part of like processing and growing in a way, is accepting that sometimes I might feel sad about that. I might be triggered about that, sometimes I might get anxious about these things, and it might trigger how I felt in the past. You know, I might be in a loving relationship, and then, you know, they might do one thing and it might make me feel unsafe, and it might make me feel, you know, because ultimately we go through life and we protect ourselves, right? It's all about weighing up our environment. Am I safe? And but we don't even realize we do it because it's so natural. But sometimes, you know, I remember saying to myself, why do I feel like this? Why do I feel like this? You know, and I think a lot of us, you know, we look at depression, and it's like, I remember being diagnosed with depression when I was like 17, and nobody, not one person, asked me what was going on in my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm depressed. Of course I feel like that. How could you not look at what I've just told you about what was going on in my life? And we've only touched the surface. And I think if we could start asking more of those questions, and even as individuals go, hang on a second, I'm feeling anxious. I've got all these feelings. I don't even know what to do with. I can't even identify the feelings. Like I'm drinking a lot to kind of dull that, or I'm pushing myself to the limits. I'm over-exercising, I'm overeating, or I'm not eating. Why am I doing that? And I think that's the biggest thing that we can do for ourselves. Why am I doing that? And then it's like, okay. And it, you know, you said, you know, you can relate to a lot of what I was talking about, but maybe you've not been through some of the, you know, you said extreme things that I've been through, but, you know,
well, they're not that extreme for some
exactly.
people.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah. And sadly, domestic abuse and sexual abuse, both men and women, is really, really common. And, but we don't like to acknowledge that, because that's hard for us to acknowledge. But then at the same time, you know, you said that, but you're absolutely right in a way, because at the same time, somebody might have been through a loss. In fact, I don't know anybody that's not lost somebody that we're close to. And that is distressing. It affects us. And, you know, there's a lot of people that have been through divorce, and sometimes there's a lot of shame attached to that divorce, but we might not see that as a traumatic experience, and we might just suck it up and, you know, carry on regardless, you know, that saying. And, but that can then influence how we go into our next relationship. And if you think about, you know, what I was saying to myself in my head and how I was feeling, that is how I see myself, and that's going to emulate and perpetuate in how I then behave around other people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when I said extreme, I was more thinking about you nearly dying in Rio when I was talking about
extreme.
That was pretty extreme. but no, I mean, I'm joking, but No, I mean, I, like you, was prescribed antidepressants when I was 17. But like you, nobody asked me what might have been at the root of that.
Exactly.
Nobody. And this was, of course, there were a lot longer ago than when you might have been prescribed, because I'm guessing I'm a bit older than you. But yeah, but no, nobody asked. Nobody really seemed to want to know. Nobody wanted to go there.
Oh, that's such a good phrase, because that is part of what we do, right? And that's what we do as a society. It's like, can we go there? But actually going there is, you know, again, I don't want to assume, but it's probably what you needed.
Yeah.
You needed somebody to go, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. These things are happening. Look at how you're feeling at the moment is linked to these things. There might be bullying at school.
Yeah.
You know, what we're supposed to just then be left to deal with it. I always say that I did a TED talk and this is what I always say. I think about how I felt throughout my life. And, you know, I know you were sharing a bit about your experience as well. And thank you for also sharing that, because it's important we do share. And I think to myself, and I said this in a TED talk, it's like we sometimes talk about, we'll hear these like moments of what happened, right? But we never talk about what we're left with, the aftermath. So, you know, if we look at bullying at school or bullying in the workplace, and then you're just left to try and deal with all those feelings, you know, a loss, it, you know, again, we might talk about, oh, sorry for your loss, but then how do you then deal with all that emotion? And we just don't talk about the aftermath. And that's what kind of trauma is, really. And that's what my book is. It's like, when you're sat there alone and you're like, well, I'm isolated in all these feelings. What am I supposed to do now? And I want the book to help people feel less isolated in it, because I really believe that we can, you know, I want to be empowering and hopeful as well, but I also don't want to shine something up that's horrible. Sometimes I think we should say, you know what, that's horrible what's happened. You don't need to friggin' make a positive out of it. But you can grow through it, and it's important to validate our experiences. And that hurts. That hurt me. That made me feel like that. And but there is so much power in that, because you're like, yeah, you know what, I feel like that too. And that's okay. And that's normal. And you know, we can grow through those things, but when we're in isolation, that's really damaging, and that's, people lose their lives in that situation. I've had that, close people lose their lives and they've gone through things. And to me, it's because they were isolated in their own thoughts and feelings.
Oh, completely agree with you. And as I say, I completely empathize with everything that you're saying, because it mirrors many things in my own life. And, you know, things like divorce. Yes, I've been divorced twice. And in fact, I got married very young, the first time I got married. And looking back, I realized that I just wanted somebody to look after me, because I didn't feel safe. And I haven't had that feeling of safety all through my life until quite recently, when I managed to talk about it and get through it and get to that point where I could say, I no longer have that gnawing feeling of being unsafe, of feeling unsafe, nothing tangible, but this kind of nebulous kind of in your core. And that's been throughout my entire life until, as I say, quite recently, the last few years. And, you know, so my first marriage, I think I married this man because I wanted somebody to look after me, because I was, you know, having problems with depression. I didn't feel safe. I'd had problems. I'd left home early and of course it didn't work out. And so then what happened, right? You get thrown into now this other thing. So for some people, and for certain stages of my life, it's always felt like you've gone from one crisis to the next.
Yeah.
And then who wants to know about it? Nobody really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who do you talk to about it?
But then I feel like, honestly, just saying what you're saying, I feel like, you said, oh, who wants to talk about it? But honestly, I feel like there's I was going to say thousands, but I'd say millions of people in the world yes. that can relate to exactly what yeah. you're saying. And then, and like you said, you feel very alone in it. And that's because of, yeah. you know, one, how trauma makes us feel and those distressing experiences. But also sometimes because society can basically put a lid on it, society's attitude, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's even, I mean, I'm so glad that you have worked, you know, you've been working through, I don't want to use past tense because I feel like sometimes it's always a bit of yeah. a work in progress, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, you're working through and feeling safe now, but I just know, I mean, I know my mum would relate to you so much. Like I kind of was listening to you and it, again, it's like, you know, you wonder the decision, or you wonder maybe what would have happened if you had have been helped at that point when you were diagnosed with depression and somebody actually asked you,
mm-hmm.
You know, how you were feeling, not how you were feeling in terms of the depression.
Because yeah, they ask really you how you're feeling, but but they don't go into any further I'm okay. than that.
yeah. Just feel yes. a bit depressed. Yeah. You know, it's like,
yeah, I'm all right.
But, you know, what's going on in your life?
Yeah.
Because it's also really hard for us to identify how we're feeling. That was one of my struggles.
True.
Like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm feeling. I'm just, you know, or I'd just say, oh, yeah, I'm fine. Because you used to being the strong, you know, just like pushing it down. And actually, you know, it makes sense to me exactly why you went into those relationships. And it goes to what I was saying around, like, when we don't process those feelings and understand what we're feeling, we do make those decisions to search for that, but quite a lot of the time they can be unhealthy.
Yes.
You know, I've done the same, like, and they can be unhealthy behaviors. And that's why we do see sometimes this cycle of unhealthy relationships when people go from one unhealthy relationship to another.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I can relate to that. And I remember I was in one relationship where I was like, oh my gosh, it kind of hit me. I'm doing everything that I didn't want to do, that I wanted to try and change. And I could just see my mom in my, in me. Mm. And I was like, what am I doing? But in a way that sometimes the unsafety can feel safer because it's a familiar environment.
Exactly. That is, and that is one of the awful things about it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's familiar and you're more scared of what's unfamiliar.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. And sometimes safety and love can feel more scary because, because especially if you've been hurt in the past. And, you know, I remember, you know, when I was writing the book and even when I first saw a clinical psychologist, I'm like, how do I even, she was like asking me how I felt and how I don't even know. I just feel hurt. I just feel in pain. And to me, that's kind of what trauma is, really. Whatever we've been through, it's not about what we've been through. It's about what we've been left to fail. And you do feel that pain, which I can imagine you felt at that time. And then you're looking for that safety, for that love. And quite often when it comes from a place of pain, it ends up attracting that unhealthy situations.
That is so true. Well, we still have more to come from Charlie Webster, but first it's time for another short break. Back right after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
You're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I'm talking trauma today with my guest, Charlie Webster, the broadcaster and journalist. I'd opened up about some of my trauma before the break and how I could now see how trauma might have informed my choice of husband many years ago. Here's how we continued.
Only in hindsight, though, can I say that, right? At the time, I didn't feel that at all. And, well, we could talk all day about this, seriously.
And I, I just want to say one thing about what you said in hindsight, and actually it's a really good point, because what I really should say and should have said is that we do all this really quite subconsciously.
Yeah.
It's not like we're doing it on purpose. Of no. course we're not. But we do it subconsciously because it's still there. And this is the thing I want to try and get across. And the biggest thing I've learned and the biggest thing that's helped me is like, we can ignore it. But it doesn't mean it's not there. It's in our subconscious and it influences us in those ways. And until you actually bring it into your conscious and understand what you've been through and understand how it impacts you, only then can you repair.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my eyes are getting a bit wet
right now
as we're talking. I'm getting very emotional here, sitting here talking with you. But look, it's been wonderful sharing with you today, because I feel that's what we've been doing, kind of sharing a bit. And it's great to hear about your book and everything that you're doing. And so, you know, we're probably going to have to bring this to a close now, because we could talk all day. And that
I know, I feel like we could carry on.
but we are coming to a close. And just for our listeners, where can they find your book? Where can they find out more about what you're doing? You know, tell us a bit more about all of that.
And thank you. And thank you for sharing. I appreciate you also sharing in this conversation. I want to make sure I acknowledge that.
Oh, thank you.
You know what? And emotions are good, right? We have emotions for a reason.
They are good.
But it's hard when you're trying to present a radio show.
That is true too.
So my book is called Why It's Okay to Talk About Trauma. And it really is. I say this as in, like, you know, you can pick up the book and it can just be between the book and me and you. You know, if that's the first step, that's totally okay. And I hope it can be, you know, it's there to read. It is written as a journey, but you can pick it up anytime as well. And hopefully it'll just be a bit of safety and a bit of companionship and help you understand. It's available pretty much everywhere, worldwide, you know, the bookshops in each country, but it's also available on Amazon, but I also promote independent bookshops. So,
We like that.
But it is available, you know, worldwide everywhere. You can just maybe Google it, Why It's Okay to Talk About Trauma. And if you would like to contact me, my social media, my Instagram is just my name. So it's at Charlie Webster.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also have a website and a contact form. And I'd love to hear what everybody thinks, really. But my website is just charliewebster.com.
Brilliant. Well, that's simple. And
just remember my name and you'll find me.
Exactly, which is fantastic. Well, Charlie, thank you so much for joining me on the show and for talking about trauma. And we really do need to talk about it more. It's swept under the carpet far too often. So well done, and thank you so much. And thank goodness you got through all of that in Rio. I mean, for heaven's sake.
I know.
It's unbelievable that you went through all that and survived. So you must be here for a reason, right?
I really hope so. And if I can just give that back, then maybe that's what I'm here for.
I think that's probably very true, what you are here for. So thank you so much for everything that you're doing, and keep up the good work. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Charlie Webster there, a woman of courage if ever there was one. Now, hay fever or seasonal allergies might not be life-threatening, but it can be extremely unpleasant and have a major impact on our lives. And some of us don't want to take drugs or antihistamines to combat it. That's where Nasal Guard comes in, a drug-free product that's safe and simple to use, but also highly effective at keeping airborne particles out of our bodies. Tammy Taylor knows all about the ill effects of pollen and dust. She lives in the hay fever capital of the USA. That's Wichita in Kansas. And her allergy symptoms have been so bad, she uses Nasal Guard spray rather than the gel to top up her allergy shots and stay functional. I asked her when she first started using Nasal Guard.
So I'm going to say it's been 13, 14 years ago now. I actually had a allergy workup. So I had all the pricks on the skin and told me exactly what I was allergic to here in Kansas. So it was everything from the grass starting to grow, the bees moving the pollen, the trees starting to bloom, flowers, and then going all the way through summertime. And once we found out what I was allergic to, my allergy doctor, you know, we're going to give you shots, but there's some extra boost type of thing that you may try. And so he gave me a long list of different things, and nasal guard was in there. I try to keep as natural as possible. I don't like a lot of medicines, and nasal guard was something that seemed to work for me here in the middle of Kansas.
How bad was it? How did it affect your life?
Running nose, red eyes, coughing, just because of the drainage all the time. Some days were worse than others, so I would try to stay in, but you know, you could only filter so much from the outside to come in. But I take a couple showers a day when I'm out and about, because trying to get the pollen and off the body and change clothes, it was quite an ordeal. It made me look like a old crying woman.
Yeah, it's not a good look, is it? I know. Yep. So tell me, how did nasal guard help you?
Well, with the allergy shots and then being able to use that, and I use it probably definitely twice a day. Some days it was probably three times a day. Just kept my sinuses moist for one thing, but then, you know, opening it up. I know that the menthol part of it kind of is, you know, what opens everything so that you can smell and breathe, and that helped with the coughing part.
Do you find it intrusive, or do you find it really easy to use?
I find it very easy to use. The applicator, you know, give a squirt and a sniff. And so I do it in the morning, especially during my allergy times. I don't have to use it quite as much during the winter times. You know, I kind of have a cycle that I am an avid user or type of thing. But no, I carry it, you know, in my purse, and therefore if I feel that it wears off, I can go to the bathroom and it's just a little applicator that you take off the top and, you know, it squirts up in there, and I always hold the other side of my nose and do the sniff and then change and sniff it up. And I find that the little squirt is about the right amount, you know, and then I let it set for a minute to see if it starts to effectively work. So it's just one spray into each nose and continue on my way. Seem to, within 10, 15 minutes, can feel some more breathing, or better breathing, I guess.
So you find it very easy. You carry it with you all the time. And it does sound like you've had a really, you know, you've been dealt a very bad hand when it comes to allergies. How does it make you feel when you know that you can actually go about your life without having to look like you're a completely bedraggled wet kitten with, you know, your nose streaming?
Well, it's definitely made it a lot better. I mean, makeup's not running down my face. Like I say, I took those allergy shots, and so that did reduce it during, and has continually to reduce it. It makes a big difference once you can get that, you know, before I start to get on a phone call or something, and it's natural, so it's not necessarily a drug. And if I feel that I need a squirt before I head into a meeting or something, I know that I'm opened up and be able to speak without sneezing, snorting, or coughing.
Yeah, that's important as well, isn't it? Because it's not a drug. So you can use it, and you're using it in conjunction with your shots. Yep. So what it does is it gives you that extra help that you obviously need. And so how long does the season last there? I mean, you have allergies all year round, do you?
I do not. So mine start probably the end of February, 1st of March, because that's when here in Kansas, everything starts to activate after coming out of the winter. Mine goes through our corn harvest. So as a child, in the middle of the wheat harvest, the wheat dust and everything. And then we also planted corn, and that was my most, so corn and wheat overlapped. Wow. Yeah. And the flourish pollen part of the corn is the same time as the wheat dust. So my end of June, 1st of July, which is coming up, is my heavy season. And then end of August is kind of when harvest finishes with what I'm allergic to. But then it goes into another harvest of soybeans and milo and stuff, but I'm not allergic to those. So I would say March through the end of July is my season.
Yeah, well, that's long enough, isn't it, to be suffering? So, well, I'm really glad to hear that it has done such a good job for you, and the fact that it doesn't interfere with anything that you're taking, like the shots that you have, it doesn't interfere with those at all.
A success story there. If you want to try Nasal Guard for yourself, just click on the link on the UK Health Radio homepage for worldwide delivery. And that brings us to the end of today's show, brought to you in association with Nasal Guard, the drug-free nasal gel that uses electrostatic technology to block harmful airborne contaminants as well as indoor and outdoor allergens. If you want to find out more about me, then do check out my websites, thepracticalalchemist.uk and also safehavenhealing.uk. For now, though, there's just time to say thank you for listening. Join me next time. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.